Today we have Joel Friedlin on the episode, and we talk about industrial real estate. Not only do we talk about industrial real estate and how it is the playground of the wealthy, and afterwards it a little bit depressing, you know, comparing it to multifamily and, you know, single family real estate long-term holds, is that we also talk about the state of the commercial real estate marketplace. I think that I really enjoyed Joel's depth when it came to the commercial landscape of real estate in North America, the industrial space that ultimately he is so well experienced in and that has a great in-depth knowledge of. Again, an episode that is a little bit outside of the norm of residential real estate, but at the same point in time, we do speak quite a lot about residential and the parallels with the industrial marketplace. But then also we speak a little bit about the debt that's coming down the pipeline for the commercial office space marketplace and how that will ripple effect through everything else. Again, wide-ranging conversation that I certainly believe you'll enjoy. And it's great to have that type of knowledge when you're speaking to your high net worth individual clients to make sure that they can see that you've got scope over the entire market. Hope you enjoy. Welcome to Rethink Real Estate. My name is Ben Brady, and this is a real estate podcast aimed to deliver sales strategies, marketing tips, and business insights from industry experts and myself to build a listing-focused business for the future. Let's get into it. Joel, welcome to Rethink Real Estate.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to see you.
Have to admit, pretty excited about this episode because I'm always curious about spaces that are outside of the residential real estate marketplace because, you know, at the end of the day, one, you get to play outside of your sandbox a little bit and, you know, have a lateral view of something different that's sort of running a little parallel to the residential marketplace. But also your expertise in it because, you know, at the end of the day, doing my research before the episode itself, it looks like you've got a pretty extensive background. But while we're on that topic is that if somebody's tuning in and listening, why should they hang around?
Well, I'm going to talk about something that most people are unfamiliar with, which is industrial real estate, which is the playground of the wealthy. So the buildings that we broker and own, we're both brokers and we're syndicators, so we're owners as well. Most of the buildings that we own are occupied by family businesses that are generations old, where grandpa started the business and now there's a very often a warring group of cousins that now own the property. And so when they're warring and they're manufacturing their products, they say, let's get rid of the building. Let's get rid of the company. Let's cash out. So they want to sell to a private equity group. They sell to some very well-backed private equity group. There's hundreds of them that own manufacturing companies. And then they say, The problem is that the owners of the company, the new PE guys, don't want to own the building. So we have to sell the building separately if we want to get out of it. And that's where we come in. We buy industrial buildings from wealthy families that have been in business for generations.
It's just such a fascinating world that I don't like. I think that if you were to go into, so at the moment again, this probably dates the episode a little bit. We have a really high-end auction that we're doing up in Bel Air at the moment. And one of our marketing strategies is to go to some of the family offices of high net worth family trusts and things along those lines and market to them this distinct opportunity to park some money in. And it's interesting, like from the networks that we've been networking in, and we've done this for quite some time, is go direct to the attorneys that are obviously involved in a great deal of the property purchases and manage a great deal of the trusts and the funds and all of that stuff. It is a different rarefied air to be in when it comes to those high net worth families. A lot of their holdings are in industrial real estate. It's amazing to see that.
Yeah, industrial is great because we have net leased buildings. Our buildings that we own are between 10,000 and 100,000 square feet. And the tenants that occupy them, they pay the taxes, the insurance, the maintenance, and the utilities. So they are like hands-off investments. It's not like multifamily where somebody has to manage all these tenants and people moving in and people moving out and complaining and fighting over different things. It's such an easy management job to own an industrial building. So families that inherit these buildings from their dad or their grandfather, they don't mind owning them for a while. But after a while, what happens is the family starts to have disagreements. Two brothers will be fighting with each other and Jim wants to get rid of Bob. So Jim knows me and he calls me, he says, I got to get rid of Bob. I just have had it with him. I've had it with him. I hate his wife. I can't stand him. I'm done. Will you buy our building? And that's what we've done. We've bought 100 industrial buildings. And I'd say 75% have been from families that just can't work with each other anymore.
Well, so I've got a general statement that I'm going to make around my knowledge of this space from a marketplace perspective. And Joel, I want you to vigorously correct it if it's wrong. But, you know, I've a privilege to have a friend that is involved in the industrial space of things. And I know that you know, during the COVID times, the industrial space definitely didn't see what the commercial retail or office building space saw, is a rescission in the market. It saw a complete boom. And, you know, as you would expect with, you know, the online e-commerce really fueling that. And again, that probably could be a complete misassociation whatsoever. Now, keep in mind that Riverside is probably the area that I would know best. But now I know that his individual business himself has definitely slowed a tiny bit in the industrial space. So I just want to get your overall understanding of the last few years around what happened in the industrial space, what's happening now, and what you see going on in the future.
Yeah, so I've been in the business since 1981. Rents have not gone up much between 1981 and 2019. Rents were about $4 a square foot, triple net, when I got in the business. All the way up to 2019, they weren't much higher than $6. So they went up 50% in 30-something years. I mean, wow. It's like a little creep up of 2%, 3% a year, and then maybe 1% a year. So if you look at a graph, it goes up straight line. During 2008 and 2009, it went down, and then it came back up again. But starting in 2019, the more retail stores that closed, the more warehouses were needed because products that get shipped to your house come from a warehouse. So in 2019, it got really hot. And then with COVID, nobody expected industrial to go crazy during COVID, but people couldn't go out. So where did they order from?
Yeah.
Online. And online meant warehouses. And manufacturers had to stay in business during COVID. An office employee during COVID could stay home. But an industrial employee where they're manufacturing products sitting at work tables, they have to keep manufacturing. There's no way to stop. So this is what happened. Between 2019 and 2023, industrial rents for typical buildings that went from $4 to $6 in 30 years went from $6 to $10 or higher. It's gone up 60 to 70% in 4 years. That's rent increase. It's been crazy.
I know that number's big in association to the last 30 years of it not increasing. But it's still, you know, it actually still feels relatively cheap, or am I wrong about that?
Well, okay, so it's very interesting. Every market's different.
Okay.
The Inland Empire near you, rents are much higher, like they are on the East Coast. If you go to the New York tri-state area, rents are in the $15 range net, 14, 16. In Chicago, they're still around 9. So we're a different market. It's I can't even explain how every time I see something happen in LA or I see something happen in New Jersey, that I'm looking at it and I'm saying, it's coming here next, but we're behind, right. We're later. And it's a very interesting thing. The market is not changing at this moment. It's not going down. We're not seeing any, you know, they talk about commercial real estate is going to be it's going to bomb out and this wall of debt is coming due.
Now let's put a pin in that, because we're going to dive into that. I need you to give us the down low on that, because somebody that's got your experience, I really do want to understand that from your perspective. But again, so rents haven't decreased at anything or anything. They've obviously only just stabilized a little bit. But is it going to go up in the future? Do you think?
Yes, okay. It is. I have a great story for you. I've got a tenant in 50,000 square feet in a building that is just a regular industrial building. It's a Class B building. And this guy was on Shark Tank in year one. You watch that?
Yes, I do. Yep.
All right. It's called Element Bars. And he made a deal on TV with Kevin Harrington. And he makes protein bars. And he moved into the building 5 years ago. And last year he called me and he said, I'd like to stay. I've got a lot of equipment. I can't move it. I've got 80 employees. I don't want to relocate them. And I said, okay, well, your rent is currently $6. And I'm afraid to tell you what it's going to go up to because the market has changed. The market's 11 for your building. Hmm. He said, what? Like, he was a great negotiator on Shark Tank. If you watch the episode, they were saying, this is the best guy we've ever seen on Shark Tank. He was the same way with me. So to keep him in the building and not have a fight with him, we got the deal done in between where we thought it should be and where he thought it should be. So he's about to sign the renewal. The rents are not going down. They're just not, and I don't expect them to go down much. Industrial has a very low vacancy rate. In Chicago, our market, it's 3.5% vacancy.
Okay. Okay, that's ridiculously low if you think about it.
It's ridiculous, yeah.
So talk about the major hubs of industrial within all of North America. You mentioned New Jersey, you've mentioned Riverside, which is where we are, which, by the way, Riverside blows my mind a little bit. Now, again, I have no experience in this space at all, and I understand that from a logistics perspective, you know, the trucking side of the industry could possibly be one of the reasons for Riverside being there, but it's a long, long way away from the port at Long Beach. Like, it's like again, like it doesn't seem like it's overly, I don't know, I don't think it's logical from a location perspective. Am I wrong about that?
Well, it serves the entire west half of the country.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. And it's a giant population center. And the most important thing for industrial is labor. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a huge population center, that means that you've got a big labor pool to choose from. And that includes, by the way, not only people who work in the warehouse as distribution people driving a forklift truck, but also the manufacturing people who are making $20 an hour, sitting at tables, putting little things together to make parts. Like your microphone and my microphone, yep. 100 components in each one, all made in industrial buildings, all shipped out of industrial buildings. Your headphones, the plants behind you, everything comes from an industrial building or is made in an industrial building. But they have to have executive personnel.
Got it. So
that's why they're in the big cities, because they have to have managers, they have CEOs, and a lot of them are family-owned businesses that have been located in LA or in New Jersey or in Chicago, and they're not moving away because that's where their business is, and they have to hire high-level talent. So these big centers is where industrial has to be. Now, there's a lot of rural industrial.
Yeah.
But it's a different business. I wouldn't buy an industrial building in like a small town. Grand Rapids, Michigan's a great town, but there's just not enough there. There's not enough velocity for deals and for companies who are moving. So if you have a vacant building coming up, maybe there are 500 companies that could look at it in Grand Rapids. But in Riverside, in the Chicago area, for the whole metro area, there's 20,000 companies.
Got it. Got it. So Chicago, Riverside, New Jersey, where are the other major hubs in the country?
You've got Dallas, and then you've got Miami. Miami's ridiculously expensive. Miami's like being on an island. It's so far from everything.
Got it.
It's really expensive also. But Toronto's a big one, and there's a huge amount of industrial in Mexico.
So a couple of questions off the back of that, and I want to get to the Mexico thing here shortly and how China has affected, you know, some of the industrial side of the business over here from a manufacturing perspective. But the thing that I really want to sort of understand is that if you're looking for some up and coming industrial spaces, is it something like that, like, you know, how, like, a great example of this, if you could have bought in Bend, Oregon or Boise, Idaho before COVID happened, you should have, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is there any spots that we should be on the lookout for up and coming industrial areas within North America at the moment?
No, they're already pretty saturated with new properties. There's enough there. Nashville, Dallas, yep. Houston, Phoenix, Salt okay. Lake City. There's been a lot built. There is a possibility that there will be vacancies coming up because of developers overbuilding. Developers have a no-lose situation. These are multimillionaires who have enough money that they could retire, but they're in industrial real estate because it's fun. I'm not kidding. People who are super wealthy that I know, what they do when they sell their business is they say, I'm going to go into real estate. What kind of real estate should I go into? The easy one, industrial. Net leases, companies that pay the rent, companies that stay in the buildings for 15 or 25 years. It's a really great, as I said, it's the playground for the wealthy in terms of investing and pension funds. So developers, like your friend, if your friend hears this, I'm not trying to be insulting, but
no, go for it.
If your friend,
he won't care, trust me.
If your friend has relationships with pension funds, really with advisors of pension funds, insurance companies, they all love industrial because they can put a ton of money to work, hundreds of millions in a single project. So if they can get a hold of land, which is hard to get, and they can get it entitled, which is easier in some places than others. Chicago's easier than most. They can build a 500,000 square foot building with the pension fund's money. They get an upfront fee and they get a promote, which is a carried interest like the hedge fund guys get in the on the back end if they sell it for a big profit, maybe 20% of the profit from the sale. So right. If you do a $100 million deal with somebody else's money and you get a fee up front, and just say it's $1 million, of course you're going to do it. What's your downside?
Yeah.
And then on top of it, if you can sell it in 3 years to another pension fund and you make, say, $20 million on it, it's a $4 million pop
yep.
to the developer who made $1 million up front plus some other things.
Yeah.
So he's making $5 million on just taking on a project.
Joel, I've got to admit this conversation is depressing the shit out of me about my multifamily stuff at the moment.
Well, it's funny. There's a group of investors who all communicate with each other and they invest in syndications. And I'm a syndicator. So my investors put in $50,000 or $100,000 each. And none of them have ever really done industrial. And I did a couple of podcasts that hit these people. And all of a sudden I'm getting all these inquiries like, how do I get in with you in industrial? Yeah. Because I'm my multifamily's struggling and they've stopped paying the distributions on a few of them. And I'm getting these horrible letters that they had floating rate debt and they need rescue money. And my answer is I wish I could find deals.
Yeah.
It's really hard because our market's so tight in industrial. The biggest problem I have is finding things to buy.
But that said, though, multifamily was like that for a period of time through the COVID boom and everything along those lines. Will you see industrial go through the same thing that multifamily is going through at the moment, where it's just there's a saturation because there is overbuilt? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I went through 2008, where literally I was just devastated. I had 50 industrial buildings and they did go down in value and there were definitely vacancies. It was traumatic.
But was it to the point though? Was it to the point you can hold on though?
Well, I had 50 deals that were before 2008 were great. They were cash flowing 10% and we were sending out the money. 10 of those deals turned into losers and I struggled really hard to save them. So let me give you the perspective that you're looking for. In these days where residential or multifamily office people, retail people know that they're in trouble and their lenders know that they're in trouble, it doesn't all of a sudden happen where these properties come on the market at a discounted price because it's like fishing. I'm going to give you the fishing example. You're on the back of a yacht and you've got you're fishing and there's a sunfish and you get the sunfish on the hook. He doesn't just say, hey, I got a hook in my mouth. I'm going to jump in the boat and make it easy. When trouble starts, it keeps going because lenders do something called extend and pretend, which means they do forbearance agreements. That's where they let the borrower take a little break from paying, pay us later, we'll accrue the interest now, but you'll pay us later if you can turn it around. And I call it the developer stall. developers stall as long as they can, hoping against all hope that even though things are crap, that they're going to turn it around and make it work and not lose the property. And that's usually a 3 to 4 year process.
Okay.
So the trouble that's happening today, you're not going to see most of it until 2026 and 2027, because the developers and the owners that are having those troubles are like, they're hanging on for dear life, and they'll play every game. They'll do the Trump thing. They'll file lawsuits to delay. So maybe if the market gets better, or if the Fed brings rates down, they'll be able to save the day.
Got it.
But 90% of those are going to have trouble, and they're going to continue fighting, and it's going to be, they're in depressions. They're lying on their couch right now. They're freaked out.
And just to clarify as well, we're talking about the same in the commercial office space as well. Now,
that's the worst one.
That's the worst one. So now I want to segue into the perspective. I want to come back and I want to talk about the international influences, because I've heard some stuff around that, but I want to segue into this now because it's obviously right on topic for us. General perspective of the commercial marketplace is that, you know, there's a great deal of ceiling of debt that is resetting in the office space. You know, there's certain areas where it's area specific, like Midtown Manhattan. You know, some of those buildings are just literally sitting there. Like I heard an analogy one time that I've said a few times on the podcast that I'll repeat, is that people have said that in some markets that, you know, the buildings are going to be like the pyramids. They look good, but ultimately they serve absolutely no purpose. Yeah. And in some markets they're right, like San Francisco. I'm not sure how Chicago is rebound. You know, I don't know that market very well. Like all of those individual areas of that high density, office space where, you know, something that isn't modern isn't retrofitted. Like I know, for example, the Transamerica building in San Francisco, someone bought it pre-COVID for $600 million and has put like $300 million into it remodeling. And I know I've got a colleague of mine that actually is in that building. He turned around and has tried to ask them to increase their rent because of all the modernization. They turned around and said, absolutely not. You know, there's a great deal of trouble there. First of all, is that trouble something that everybody should be worried about? Is it big enough trouble that it can ripple effect to everything?
It absolutely will. Yes. 100% yes. Nothing's immune from a downturn. A downturn's bigger than all of us. There's nothing we can do about it. I by the way, have one strategy that I just have to throw in there. We do all of our deals today. When we buy a $3 million building as a syndicator, we do it all cash, no mortgage. Because I got just traumatized in the 2008 through 2014 period. And I've decided there are enough wealthy investors who like the idea of not losing their money and having a nice little steady 7 or 8% cash flow. And so I'm in that arena because I'm scared shitless of what you're saying about having bigger buildings with debt. I have a story where there's a building that I know very intimately that's owned by a group where I'm friends with the sponsor or the head guy. It's a $150 million investment that they made with a $117 million loan. And they're selling the building for $17 million. They're losing $100 million of the loans going away and $30 million of their equity is going away. And I have one friend who's really smart. He put together a group and he's buying all these office buildings for $17 million. And it's like, how can you lose when you buy a building that just a few years ago was worth 10 times more? You're buying it for 15 cents on the dollar. He's making a bet. That's gambling, man. That is gambling. Because I don't
think it's a long bet. It's a long bet as well.
Long bet. Oh. Yeah,
I don't
think that stuff's coming back. But yes, it will impact. When good friends of mine in 2007 in multifamily were seeing trouble, I said, I'm an industrial. I'm not seeing any trouble. Guess what? It hit us. When there's a tidal wave, it doesn't matter how tall you are. Right?
Yeah.
The short guys and the tall guys all get knocked down by the tidal wave. But industrial is different because companies have to distribute products and companies have to make products. So when the vacancy rate's 30% in San Francisco on office buildings, it might be 7 or 10% on San Jose industrial buildings.
Yeah, fair. Fair. I think that there's a part of this, there's a part of this as well that as I'm thinking through it, is that I guess that the part of the office space thing that is, that, again, there's so many different theories out there in the sense that it's not a big enough marketplace to affect everything else because it only is the markets, like the total market itself only makes up about 10% of the total commercial marketplace in all of the country. But then office itself, okay, in the areas that are affected is only 2 or 3% in total of the actual overall commercial space that is available from an office perspective. Now, again, like there's theory upon theory of different people saying it won't affect or it will affect because there's this, and I think that people are at this point a little bit tired of hearing about it because that's really one of the things that a lot of people are saying could be the ultimate downside for real estate is that, you know, the interest rates going up, you know, didn't overly affect the real estate prices. It only affected volume of transaction, which honest is even worse.
Yeah, like no, that's wrong. Yeah. No, you're heading into the territory that I know unfortunately too well. It's called It's called cap rate compression.
Okay.
What happened was the cap rates, which is the return that the property is sold for, back in the day when I was doing my deals before 2008, when interest rates just went down to, you could borrow money long-term for an office or an industrial building at 3%.
Yep.
Back in the day when they were trading for 10% returns, you'd buy $1 million building for $100,000 worth of income. That was normal for a long time. Slowly but surely, the cap rates, which is the return that investors are willing to accept, went down, down, down. And when the cost of money went down, when the Fed reduced the and threw money into the economy and reduced the amount that you could borrow for, cap rates went down. If you had a pulse from 2009 until 2023, you made a fortune in real estate, and the more debt you put on it, the better.
Okay.
But cap rates are going up. This has not happened in 15 years. They're going up. And when a cap rate goes up from 5% to 6%, the property value goes down 15%. If there's a 20% loan on the property, the investor has just been wiped out of 75% of their investment on paper. If the cap rate goes up to 7, which is way below what I consider to be normal, they're wiped out and the lender is going to take a loss. So it's not just office buildings. The cap rates are part of every kind of investment real estate, whether it's single family homes, multifamily, retail, restaurants, anything. So like a Walgreens used to be able to, you could buy them for a 5% cap rate.
Right.
It's gone up. So a family that traded into a Walgreens from selling their family business building, they're underwater in the last year and a half, and it will get worse.
When does it all happen? When is enough enough? Because the other part that is obviously that I know is that it's not the big institutions that lend on the commercial element. It's the smaller institutional banks that do so.
Well, it's also insurance companies.
Got it.
That's a misconception that people on the news say, oh, the banks are in trouble. It's not really the banks. It's insurance companies. Like there's an insurance company called Standard of Portland, Oregon. It's called StanCorp. They have hundreds and hundreds of loans on office and industrial and multifamily buildings. Insurance companies have to put their money somewhere. And the best return and the safest way that they've been able to get for the past 10 or 15 years is allocating a bunch of it to commercial real estate. So the banks actually aren't in as much trouble as people are saying. But these insurance companies are looking at it and they're saying, our books are looking a little bit richer than they really are.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Understood.
So, but that's going to have a ripple effect. It's all going to start crumbling in the next 3 years unless something happens that nobody's expecting that's going to turn the economy around and make it just take off. But with all the national debt, with $33 trillion in national debt, we got bigger problems. How are we going to solve that problem? So I don't see how the economy is about to get really hot. I see that there's got to be a downturn. So commercial real estate's got to go down.
Right. So if we segue away from that side of it is that you know, China is that I just heard just recently is that China has four times the volume of debt on real estate than what North America did in the, or the US did anyway, just before 2008 happened. They have four times the volume of debt on real estate in their countries before than what the US did in, before 2008. Their real estate marketplace has taken a downturn. Their economy is obviously not going very well off the news, the fact that they're not growing from a population perspective anymore. What that's driven is this question around, you know, this little engine that's at the bottom of the US, which is Mexico, you know, and the opportunity that there is in the industrial, the manufacturing side of the business in Mexico as well, that's fueled by sort of China's downturn, so to speak. That's what, again, that was just something I recently heard only a couple of days ago on a podcast that I was listening to. Is there any truth in that?
Yeah, there's a ton of it going on. Mexico's booming in industrial, and there's a whole number of reasons for that. One is because you don't have to ship stuff through over the ocean and through the canal, right? Mm-hmm. It's right there. You can truck it. In 5 hours or 7 hours, you can be in Dallas or you can be in Phoenix. It's because there's a political uncertainty with regard to China. And the companies that I work with, my tenants, what they're doing is they are moving their production, which all moved over to China for years and years and years. They're all coming out of China. They're going to Vietnam and India because it's more stable and because it's cheaper. And they're coming to Mexico because they have to have something close by. That's called reshoring or onshoring. Mm. And they talk about how that's happening all over the United States. It is in some parts, but mostly close to the Mexican border, and, right. And it's happening in Mexico. So, and there's another thing that's really important is there has to be enough power to run these companies, and the grids in certain areas are stronger than other areas. You can't move your place if you can't turn on your machines.
Yeah.
So what companies that are relocating are looking at is what's the grid like in some of these countries. And if the grid's not strong enough to manufacture, they could go down because they don't have it. You know, when you in your house, when you flick a switch and the electric goes off, that doesn't work well for manufacturers. Mm. So the US has a great grid, but in certain locations, and Mexico has a great grid, but in certain locations. So a lot of this, there's a lot of international thought process here. But I'm just looking at the US. A lot of companies are bringing their stuff back from China to here instead of going to Vietnam because they want it close. Because during COVID, there was that supply chain disaster where you couldn't get products. There was nothing. We couldn't get roofs on our industrial buildings built. The materials weren't available. And when we got them, the pricing was given to us the day we bought it. We had to say yes to any price.
It's kind of like having to solve the issue. It's kind of like having to solve the issue of the gas problem that we have from the Russia situation. We had to really shore up our own on like our own supplies in order to make sure that we weren't vulnerable to that in the future. That's what people are doing from an industrial space perspective.
That's exactly parallel. You're 100% right. Yeah.
So I guess that Joel, I think that one of the things that I sort of want to sort of end out with is sort of just your overall view on the industrial space from an investor perspective. You know, leading over the next few years, what would you tell the people that are listening that whether they're in industrial, whether they're in residential, multifamily, whatever it may be, what's the best way for somebody to get involved in industrial?
Well, individuals can get involved in the REITs. There are a number of industrial REITs. Prologis is an example. First Industrial is another, but that's stock market. So I'm not a fan of that. The stocks sell for a multiple that may be greater than the total value of all the properties. There are private industrial real estate syndicators, which is what I do, but I do it on a very, very small scale. But there are 4,000 syndicators in the United States with more than $50 million of assets under management, and a very small percentage is industrial. It's less than 10%. And so there's a group of industrial syndicators that people who are syndication serial investors know about. And We have only four of them in Chicago. And then there's a bunch of them just all around the country. A lot of them are in small towns. I've got one guy in Peoria that I know, Peoria, Illinois, and that's someone who's in Iowa and Des Moines. It's through these syndicators who put out deals that are 20 million, 10 million at a time. That's how people can get involved.
Okay. Well, that definitely triggers my interest. Speaking to you obviously creates this want to sort of talk further about the industrial opportunity that there is for, you know, that passive income element that's far more stable than some of the other avenues, or the critical mass that you have to get to on a residential or multifamily perspective to then have that fluctuation of the stuff that isn't performing at all times as well. So I think that there's a part of this that is definitely intriguing. Final part of this is a little bit of our personal stuff, Joel. I guess that from what we like to ask our guests on Rethink Real Estate is a little bit more about themselves and understanding, where do you get your information from? What are your morning routines and habits or life hacks that you might want to share to people out there? But again, you're a very well-informed person in the industrial space from being in it. Where are you getting a great deal of that information on a daily basis? Is it podcasts you listen to, books, magazines, emails, newsletters? What is it?
I belong to an organization called the Society of Industrial and Office Realtors, and it's 4,000 members strong all around the world. And these are experts who are the top brokers primarily in the field. And there's a tremendous amount of chatter between all of us. So I get a lot of the information. It's like getting comps. It's like when you call another broker and say, hey, can you share this with me? I've got this thing in Bel Air. I have no idea how to price it. I'm sure you do know how to price it, but you know, you say, I'm not sure, I don't know. And so most of the information we get for our business is from personal relationships. It's kind of a closed system. There is no MLS for industrial, but there is something called CoStar and there is something called LoopNet. Mm-hmm. And so those are subscriber data dumps, you know, where you can get any information. So those are some of the places. My favorite answer to how do I get information is I cold call. I literally still cold call. I go door to door cold calling in industrial parks. I've got a son and a partner in the business. We all cold call every week. That's how we stay fresh.
And when you say cold call, you're just calling on people, talking about their situation, how the business is going.
I have no fear. I will walk into an industrial building where there's 100 cars in the parking lot, and there's a receptionist sitting there at the front in the office, and there's a bunch of people working, making products in the back. I will literally walk in the front door and say, I'll have the name of the owner. Let's say it's Bob Smith. Hey, is Bob Smith here? We own a building a few doors away, and we want to talk to him about industrial real estate in the neighborhood. I get right in, I sit in his office, and I absorb information from Bob. First of all, I say, would you like to sell your building? Because I'll buy it and lease it back to you. And they always say no, because nobody wants to sell. But yeah, That's how we get the information. How's business? How's manufacturing? What are you seeing? It's personal.
I think that that's one of the things that you could definitely take away, regardless of what space that you're in, is that if you're out there talking to the people and understanding the parallels of each individual situation, gives you that really good foresight within the entire marketplace.
Oh, yeah. And as far as habits and things like that, I've watched Julia Gentry on your podcast. I'm the opposite. I'm a late night person. This is crazy. I eat dinner. My wife and I, we're empty nesters. Our kids all live near us, but they're out of the house. And about 10 o'clock at night, I drink coffee. And then I go work out for an hour and a half. And I watch the news, movies, podcasts. And I work out till midnight. It's the opposite. My wife said to me, I was going for a checkup to the doctor, and she said, you better talk to the doctor about that stupid schedule of yours. Nobody does that. And I get peace. I have peace at midnight until 1 a.m. when I go to sleep. And I sleep 8 hours and I wake up at 8:30 or 9 o'clock. It's the opposite of most people. I never make an appointment until 11 a.m. because I'm just not a morning person. So I went to the doctor and I said, my wife's very concerned because I drink coffee and work out late at night. And the doctor says, it's really interesting. That's what I do.
Oh, that's cool.
That was a twist. That's cool.
So well, that's it. And then your wife, you came home and you told your wife, and she's like, you better get another doctor.
Exactly.
Well, again, that's, you know what? That's, it's funny. I don't know why, but like, I've made myself into a morning person because I think that that's what I needed to do.
You're younger. Trust me. You're younger.
Yeah. I would prefer to do it later at night. Trust me, I would. But like, again, I think that society has always pushed you to be like, you've got to be a morning person. You've got to be the 5 a.m. club person, all that stuff. And I don't know that that's the truth, because ultimately, if you like, I know for a fact, our marketing guy, Chris, who will edit this episode and cut it all up, and he's on the podcast every now and then with some marketing tips and everything. And Chris, like, I get emails from 1:28 at night, in the morning, and I call him and I'm like, are you just sending those like to just show me that you're working at night or whatever? He's like, no, I genuinely get more done because the house is quiet. You know, I can think better. I just am a night person. And Chris doesn't, and he would hate me sharing this, but Chris doesn't wake up until 9 o'clock. Like, if I try and get him before 9, there's no chance. But if I wanted to get him at 9:30 at night, there's no problem at all.
Exactly. Same thing. Listen, I'm 64, and I've come to the conclusion that whatever my favorite schedule is good enough. When I was younger, I was right there. I was starting at 8 o'clock in the morning, which for me was really early, because as a college graduate, just getting into the business, we always stayed up all night eating pizzas and doing whatever. And I started my first job in real estate, and it was, hey, you have to be here at 8 o'clock. And I said, I don't know how I'm going to do that. I have no idea. So I've worked my way back to starting later and later and staying up later and later. And I love it. It's great.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And I think that there's some really great advice that you've gotten out of this and some really great insight. Joel, thanks so much for joining us on Rethink Real Estate. Really enjoyed the chat.
Thank you, Ben. You too.
So about 75% of our audience hasn't liked, followed, or subscribed to our podcast. It would mean the world to us, and it would help this podcast more than you know to expand our reach if you were to like, follow, or subscribe on any of the platforms that you're watching or listening on. Thanks again.